given some of these vacancies that have arisen, one of them which I didn't raise, we may think that this one does need to go to be certified as well. That's another delaying issue which I didn't raise earlier. So these things aren't just done during the process, but have to go through its own process itself. Now what we need to do is to ensure that we make the most of this opportunity right now, which is 1.5 hours to start with, before continuing. So I'm looking at Treasury, because at the last meeting we'd asked him to come back with certain things, and they won't be able to be here tomorrow. So we may have to, and I'm looking at the advocate as well and everyone, because you all had a meeting, and the DDG of, you know, the train industry, Dr. Masorcha. So I'm hoping that this has been ironed out, as well as the National Credit Regulator and the Consumer Tribunal. So are we ready? I'm just looking at Treasury, at the Chief Director there, just to, so that we can begin to manage the time.
Chair, we're just waiting for Ms. Gibson. She's finishing off on the presentation.
Right, well what we'll do, so as not to waste time on the matter, let us take the bill out. Oh gosh. No. Have you all got B2018? What makes this one different? We? No, I'm saying effectively on. Have you got what was handed out this morning? Right. It appears to be the same from the cover, but it has incorporated the changes that were made. All right. So what I would like you to do, we are going to be starting off clause by clause, but I would first of all like to address those clauses where the changes were made. Do we understand? And what I'd like to do then is, I understand we're going to ask Advocate van der Merwe to lead us there with those changes, and I would ask you, because you've had some consultation with Treasury, to leave those until Treasury arrives. Is that in order? So will you be able to get on with something? Right. Can you refer to the page before the clause?
Moment, I did not prepare on the basis of looking at changes first. I just need to find those.
Honourable MacPherson.
Yeah, I just want to again just express my concern in the way in this is being handled. The other pieces of legislation that we have dealt with, we have always looked to the clause by clause reading in an entire sitting. So you deal with the bill in its entirety. What you're planning to do is to do a few clauses, or I don't know, maybe half of it today, and then some another time, maybe tomorrow, I'm not sure. And I really just appeal that we actually just think about doing it in its entirety, that the advocate, there are some clauses that they wanted to come back with or further discuss. Let's discuss that, and then let's look to schedule the entire clause by clause reading in a full sitting.
are going to do that, but we're not doing it now. We want to tackle the issues that we ask Treasury to come back to us on, as well as the advocate and DTI. So the process has been delayed due to our requests. I can't ignore the fact that the committee has asked for clarification and changes, and we are dealing with that first. Now, I hope I've made myself clear. And by the way, that is the way all bills are done. Until we've handled all those matters, and then we proceed clause by clause. We're not at the fortunate position, which I thought we would be. We're not. So we're now, you were not here, Honourable Tiako, last week when issues were raised, and we are asking for those issues to be addressed now. Do you follow? And only after all the issues that we specifically requested DTI to look at, Advocate to look at, and Treasury, only then will we be going clause by clause. We had hoped a month ago that we would be clause by clause at this moment. We're not ready. That's the point. All right, Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. The first change is on page 9 of the bill, from line 15. It is clause 14.
Once again, may I add, these are changes made last week, right, to the CREDA version.
Thank you, Chair. The concern that was raised here was that it was not clear that the tribunal could in fact reduce the interest rate and so on, because you had to read it with section 86, and we could not amend section 86 to include the word tribunal. You had to read it with changes. So the proposal was made that we then repeat section 86. And this is then from line 50 on page 9 where it is repeated. So in other words, it says, where the National Credit Regulator has made this recommendation to the tribunal in respect of debt intervention, the tribunal must then have regard to the consumer's financial means, prospects, and obligations, and may then, line 50, make an order, first, number one, declaring any credit agreement reckless, that is still the same. Subparagraph 2, on in line 55, make an order that one or more of the debt intervention applicants' obligations be rearranged by subparagraph AA, extending the period of the agreement and reducing the amount. And then this is simply repeating what section 86 reads. The crux of this amendment is on page 10, where we then, in line 4, insert subparagraph double D, determining the maximum interest fees or other charges, excluding charges contemplated in section 101E, which is credit life insurance, under a credit agreement which maximum may be zero for such period as the tribunal deems fair and reasonable, but not exceeding the period contemplated in section 86A6D. So that is the first amendment that was made, and like I say, it was simply to insert section 86, this wording specifically into this section.
Right, proceed.
Thank you, Jane. The next is then a couple of changes that related to the wording cost of credit. And the concern was that even if we use the word cost of credit in relation to section 101, subsection 1, that there might be a misinterpretation, so that cost of credit would mean almost what the word colloquially would mean, what it costs you to lend money. So if AM was excluding the principal debt. So in a number of instances, we then replaced the phrase cost of credit with of the amount contemplated in section 101, subsection 1. So I need you just to find it. It would be section 87A, so on that page, same page as we are now, page 10, it is in line 39, is the first instance where we say, or the extinguishing of a whole or a portion of the total of the amount, instead of the total cost of credit, the total of the amount. The next instance where that happens is on the next page. Apologies, Chair, I just need to find which section it is, because it has now moved in this proof. Okay, the next one is in line 52, where subject to subsection 7A, declare the total of the amount instead of the cost of credit.
Yeah, what page?
Page 11.
Yeah.
Then again 56, total of the amount instead of cost of credit. On same page. Then on page 13, in line 20, submit proof under rehabilitation that he has paid the amount contemplated in section 101 instead of the cost of credit. The same there in line 23, payment in full of those amounts. On page 13 and 25, the effect of those amounts have been resolved. It's the same issue, just on a number of spots where that issue then came up. The next big one I need to just find. The next big change was on page 18, clause 29, and what we have here is line 45, what the minister must take into account. So we have in line 45 existing industry standards, and then we have the DCRS rules. So now in that subparagraph BB in line 47, we talk about it must reflect insofar as possible the industry guidelines issued by the National Credit Regulator under the Debt Review Task Teams Agreement of 2010. So we had a problem of how to define them, and this is then how we did that. The next change is on page 19, and this relates to the period within which the minister must review. That is in line 18, where we say that the minister must first review the amount 12 months after the commencement of the Amendment Act, and then once every 24 months. It was every 12 months, we then changed it to once every 24 months. Page 19. And Chair, those were the amendments since the last time that we've presented.
Okay, and now, for those of us who were there at the time that these were raised, do we agree that they have been factored in? We're not adopting clause by clause, but I'm saying, have we covered those issues related to the cost of credit, the timing, and what was the other principle? It was the cost of credit, the timing, and there was the task team agreement being changed from the It was changed to the task team agreement from an industry adopted set of guidelines. So that has been now inserted. Right. On those clauses, DTI, did you have any difference of opinion?
Chair, good afternoon, honourable members. Good afternoon, Chair. All the issues discussed have been captured.
So now, effectively, we are ready for some of the concerns raised by Treasury in that. Honourable MacPherson?
Thanks. I'm a bit confused because I remember the when we were discussing the issue on page 19 in terms of the minister reviewing the amount applicable, I quite remember correctly that a report would be tabled to the National Assembly for the National Assembly to approve. This just speaks about a report being tabled. I'm not sure. Oh, okay, all right. I can see to the obtain the approval. Okay, thank you.
No, right. I think in the end, all we were really dealing with was the month, etc. But you know, the writing is very small, of course. Now, I'm just checking with Treasury at this particular point. I know it's not easy when you're not in your own offices trying to get things printed and so on. But several issues were raised that Treasury would like to clarify, if you recall. The Chief Director, I'm sure you've shared that with your colleagues. So would you be in a position to talk to them at this moment? What is the kind of delay we are facing? I'll tell you why I'm asking, because I don't want to go clause by clause and then come in with this, you see. Then we're dealing with it back to front. So I'd ask Ms. Naidu to kindly clarify the technicality of printing. Wondering, notwithstanding that you don't have the document right now, Ms. Gibson, but also the Chief Director, I'm sorry, you know, because we've only met recently, I know you're the Chief Director, but I have forgotten the name. I'm sorry, it is?
It is Ms. Olaudze Matsane.
Chief Director Matsane, is that right? Yes. Now, perhaps on that basis that we could begin to look at one or two of these issues and then the actual printout will come. Do you think we could adopt that position? Just looking at members generally? I'm saying we don't have the printed copies in front of us. It's not on the overhead. And I asked if we could refer to our bill and if Treasury could begin taking us through on some of the issues, or would you prefer to wait 5 minutes? Honourable Khadevin?
Chair, I prefer to wait for 5 minutes so that we know what we're looking at. We're dealing with,
All right. We're simply pausing, members, rather than adjourning. But let's just see. There's a couple of things here I had. Have you got that program for next week, Mr. Hermans? Right. The same as mine. What do you call that process, Mr. Hermans? You remember we're going to go to the state lawyer. Yeah, just go through that for us.
Chairperson, before we can proceed with adopting the report on the bill, the committee has to come to an agreement on the full bill, which is what we're trying to do, which we'll do when we do the clause by clause. Once we've completed that process, it will have to go for certification, which will be done by the Parliamentary Legal Service officers, because it's a committee bill. Also, we are then required also to submit it to the JTM for classification. Once that process is completed, we'll bring the report to the committee, because then the committee can adopt its report, because those things would have been completed. We would have had a certified bill, we would have had the JTM classifications, and then we can only formally adopt the committee report on the bill. But we cannot proceed with asking for a certification if we haven't completed the bill in totality, even if there's in totality. And then we will submit it to the Legal Service Office for certification and to the JTM for classification.
Right. Perhaps, given your experience, you could give us an idea how long this process of certification would take. I'm not sure who'd have that information. Advocate van der Merwe?
Thank you, Chairperson. The rules require that it should be the Chief Parliamentary Legal Advisor or someone designated by the Chief Parliamentary Legal Advisor who will certify the bill. The practice in our office is that the person with the committee on the bill also certifies the bill. So at this point in time, unless the content of this bill changes significantly, my certificate is prepared. I'm just waiting for the bill to be adopted so I can sign it. So that is maybe for the time it will take to walk to my office and print. The JTM is another matter. Same principle. I have already prepared my tagging opinion to the joint tagging mechanism. As soon as the bill is adopted, I can attach to that opinion. Of course, if the bill changes significantly, then I will have to change my opinion. But if it's not a significant change, if the clauses remain more or less the same, then that opinion has been prepared and is ready to be sent to the joint tagging mechanism. But I need to attach the adopted bill to that opinion for the joint tagging mechanism to consider. Our office try our best to follow up with the Speaker's office and the Chairperson's office to make sure that those signatures are received as soon as possible. If we do experience a challenge there, I might approach you, Mrs. Fudd, as Chairperson, to perhaps see if you could speed it up from a political point of view. But normally it's we've recently had a committee bill and we had the tagging signed. The one was signed within a day and another was signed within about 4 days.
So, gosh, the 4 days, let's just, be conservative here for the JTM. What is it, a couple of days for it to be certified? You're looking at 6 days, members. And that, as I understand it, members, is after we've adopted the report, all right? No? The bill. Because we can only adopt the report after the classification. So we do have to factor that timing in as well. And I'm saying that to all members present. Yes, Honourable MacPherson?
Thank you, Advocate, for that just timeline. Can I then suggest, Chair, that we as a committee agree to, this is a committee bill at the end of the day, that we agree to apply to the Chairperson for a specific day to sit, no other business except going through this bill on a clause-by-clause basis, which allows us to deal with it in its entirety. I think that would be the best and most logical way to actually deal with it, so that there's no breaks overnight or switching venues, etc., etc. We can just fully apply our mind to the bill. That's the first suggestion. The second thing I just have on a matter of process. When it comes to the clause-by-clause reading and any amendments that wish to be made or inserted, how do you wish to deal with that? Do you want those to be circulated ahead of time, or do you want them simply to be tabled when the meeting takes place, if that's how we choose to take place?
No, I think we'll go as we always have in the past. When we get to that clause-by-clause process, it is done on the spot, so to speak. We'll have it overhead, and we'll have to make sure the venue we're in, we are capable and able to get it overhead. That's the other thing. Unfortunately, I have no control of the venues, none whatsoever. So I cannot give you any guarantees there. That is under the administration entirely, and I'm not the head of administration. I can but request that this is our program. Can we please have a venue for the day or a venue for the morning? But yes, I'd be the first to say some of the venues we've had have not been conducive to deliberating on legislation at all. I do agree with you there. When it comes to this, and having it, we do want to have devote a day to it, as it were, but due to the very fact that it is a committee bill, and that we are the ones doing the instructing, as it were, we do need to give those who are taking our instructions time to implement it. So we can't just go through, as it were, and that is part of the operational challenge we face. So we do have to try and accommodate that, but I can tell you now, when you look at the program, as I think we are all doing, and you look at next week, for example, you can see we may be looking at a change to this program. Do we see that? In view of what I've just said, you saw the formal consideration of the NCAB on the 28th. Pardon? The formal. The point is that we will do that, as it were, but I want to see where we are today. We did not expect, and I'm sure you will agree, that Treasury would not have had some of these issues on the last occasion to give us, you see. We have them only today. Do you follow? So now that we have them, we can't ignore it. And that's what I'm trying to say. So no, that wasn't factored into the program. We now do have it. And the DDG of Treasury, Mr. Mamoniat, has enabled the previous deployee from there, who's now in another unit, Ms. Catherine Gibson, to join the chief director, so that now today we will have what it is where, in principle, as they say, they agree, but there are certain issues they would like to put some suggestions forward. Is this correct, Ms. Gibson? So, do we all have a copy? I'm going to now turn to the chief director and Ms. Gibson. I'm not sure who's... sorry, Chief Dunn.
We've agreed that Ms. Gibson will go through the presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Gibson.
Yes, and I think, again, thank you for giving us this opportunity. I know this bill is urgent, and as there's been the committee has really been applying its mind, and the department as well. So it is appreciated, and thank you. The presentation that's come through, I'm not actually presenting as such, I'm going to just limit it to the specific clauses. I think though it is worthwhile to say that we do support the bill, and it is important to us that, especially that the categories of persons that the bill is seeking to relieve, that we can assist those, as we've been referring as the NINAs, as soon as possible. So our first clause that we would like to propose a change is on clause 12, which is the amendment of section 86. And this clause talks specifically to powers awarded to magistrates to
Because we're also finding the pages, Ms. Gibson.
Okay, so it's on page 4 of the slide?
No, of the bill.
Oh, okay.
86A, is that 8?
It's clause 12.
Mm-hmm. 7. Thanks. Thank you, members. Right.
So, highlighting again that the preamble states that the bill is for, in effect, for NINAs who cannot exist, cannot access existing insolvency measures. This, and it then proposes various debt interventions. This clause then, and the bill is aimed at unsecured loans. This bill, this clause then applies to magistrates, but is much wider and relates to all credit agreements, including secured. So it in effect then gives powers to magistrates to be deleting, in effect, or removing to zero interest rate charges and fees. Now, our view is that this is beyond the scope of what the bill is trying to do. Particularly in light of the preamble. I understand, and we have had the opportunity to be engaging with the DTI, and I understand that there are concerns currently relating to where, in the debt review process, certain credit providers are not paying for, as it were. Now, in the wireless system, there is the DCRH, which I think you've heard of already, and many credit providers are participating in that system, but some credit providers are electing not to. And so you've got a situation where a credit provider and a borrower might be able to come to some agreement, and so it makes sense that the magistrate should be able to sign off on that agreement. But there are credit providers who are not. And so my understanding is that the intention of this clause is to reach those. The concern we have, though, is that that's a very narrow category of credit providers that we're trying to reach relative to what this clause actually enables. So we've got two concerns. Firstly is that we believe this lies outside of what the scope of the bill is primarily aimed at, which is unsecured lending. And secondly, that we understand that there is a risk related to some lenders, credit providers, but we think that this clause goes way beyond remedying what that particular concern is. So I think that, so just to give an example, I think that it was represented that, and it was a relatively low percentage, I think it was less than 20%, are consistently participating in the DCRA. But that is in terms of, well, the question is, I think that's in terms of numbers of credit providers, not in terms of the volume or value. And in fact, what that means is that actually, but probably between 80 and 90% are in fact actually going through the GCRS system. So in terms of volume and value. So we're talking here about a very big clause being put forward to remedy a relatively small portion of the market. And so our proposal in relation to this clause is then to limit it. I think there has been a lot of discussion on this clause, also in relation to the tribunal. So I understand that the tribunal clause is effectively already narrowed by virtue of the definition, but it's specifically here relating to the magistrate's powers. And so our proposal, as you can see, is to that narrow to talk specifically in relation to unsecured credit agreements. Chair, would you like me to continue with all of the proposals before engaging, or would you?
I think you had said this, but I'm looking at the slide. you then indicate, because of this concern, you would propose something.
Yes, Chair.
In
terms of the proposal, it will be the what's emboldened. So in terms of the recommendation, so it would be a change to clause CCA, and then it's adding in that in relation to unsecured credit agreements, and then the rest of the clause remains.
No, thank you for that, Ms. Gibson. Advocate van der Berge is our legal crafter here, an advisor. You've heard the concern, you've also heard the proposal that we, in fact, just add something. You know, you can see that, I'm sure, all of you. CCA here on slide 4, in relation to unsecured credit agreements, and put that in. So let us hear what Advocate van der Merwe has to say, and then come in.
Thank you, Chair. First off, I would just like to remind members that the fact that our debt intervention has a limited scope does not mean our bill has a limited scope. It's two different things. The permission that this committee has is allowing it to also address other concerns in the Act where measures aren't working effectively. That, for instance, is why we have the mandatory credit life insurance clause brought in. Now, the reason for, and in our preamble on page 3, we end by saying, and whereas to give effect to the purpose of the National Credit Act, all consumers must be afforded protection through fair, transparent, sustainable, and reasonable, responsible processes. Now, in other words, we can address the process. So it's a little catch-all phrase that we have at the end of our preamble that allows us to also go broader than our debt intervention, although the committee itself tried to limit itself to the debt intervention simply because of the impact of things not having been discussed and the impact assessments and things like that. So the reason why this specific clause is in the bill was that the committee was made aware of a court case, and I can unfortunately not remember the actual court case. If necessary, it is in the presentation I made to the committee on the submission, and I can find it quickly. But the court in that case indicated in a debt review. Now keep in mind that a debt review applies to all agreements. It's not limited to unsecured agreements as our debt intervention is. The court has said that because it is a creature of statute and because the Act does not allow it to reduce interest rates, it cannot make such an order. And so the committee was quite concerned about that, and that is then why we brought this clause in. This clause was advertised, and we received a lot of comments on it. Some of the comments were that they were concerned about the impact that this might have, how would a magistrate know, and we then added something for the minister to prescribe guidelines to the magistrate and the tribunal on how they must go about to make this reduction. And that is something that we discussed recently as well, because it was one of the latest amendments. So the minister has to keep in mind industry standards, the task team agreement, the guidelines issued under that. And one of the other things that we are specifically saying to the minister the guidelines must contain is that it must require the magistrate and the tribunal to consider incremental and proportional reduction when they're considering these maximum rates and interest rates and charges. So the intention of the committee was for this to be applicable to debt review, which means it would be applicable to both secured and unsecured agreements. I'm not saying that that is what it should be when this bill is adopted. That is a policy decision. So I don't know what to say, whether it should be secured or unsecured. What I can say is because the section applies to secured and unsecured, the intention was for this to apply to both. So I don't know if there's a concern from the DGI side about this limitation, I know that their concern and the reason for putting it in was that magistrates were limited in respect of all agreements to make this reduction in charges.
Yes, we can never forget that this is a committee bill, and it is our intention that has to be reflected here. Now, I don't want to unpack and unpack repeatedly, but do you wish to comment, DTI?
Thank you, Chair. The intention is to have this wider, to ensure that the gap is closed around that area. So the magistrates should be empowered to be able to make those orders for the interest rates. So we are in support of having this apply both ways. Thank you.
Let me now turn to the committee. Sorry, Ms. Gibson.
Sorry, just a quick point. I think what is missing in this, and I think needs to probably be captured, is that there's a distinction between where there has been a voluntary agreement between the borrower and the lender and where there hasn't been. And I think maybe it would be useful to at least capture that distinction in this clause. So in other words, where there is agreement, we don't need the magistrate to have that power. Secondly, it should be noted that there has been an impact assessment done, but on unsecured. There has been no impact assessment done on this particular impact, anything related to secured.
I think those are two important points, members. And we did say we would move on, we wouldn't wait for this further study, because a study doesn't take a month. Takes considerably longer. So I now turn to the committee. Honourable Maslobo, Honourable Williams, Honourable MacPherson. Right.
Not thanks, Chair. Thanks for the input. I think the legal team is clear. Remember the intention here. The issues of whether it's secured or unsecured. The reality is that there is an agreement that exists. We have not taken it out because even if it's unsecured, it's because certain people are entering into an agreement without actually looking at it. The most important issue, this is a dispute mechanism, the involvement of a magistrate. Why would you want to limit the powers of an adjudicator? Because now there is actually a dispute that someone can honor an agreement, whether someone has behaved in a manner that makes them more vulnerable, however they do that. Therefore, let's empower them. There is a case study that you say what the adjudicators on this dispute, they say, were not empowered by legislation to make a determination. Hence, the first thing is that they are actually given more powers so that they can make a determination. But how do you actually arrive on the question of the quantum? Then there is the power that from time to time, taking into issues of consideration, the minister will make a prescription. Therefore, you will expect that prescription that on annual basis, or whatever the timeline is, will be gazetted so that at least it becomes a point of reference, because you will know that in terms of monetary terms, there will always be changes. Therefore, to limit it, especially at the level of an adjudication, it will not serve the purpose. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable McLobo. Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. Yes, I think that this clause in its present form without the amendment suggested by Treasury is perfectly acceptable because of the fact that fundamentally there's a gap here. Currently, as we sit here, there's a gap where people fall through that gap, and this is the problem. This is why we want to address this. And I think that we should just keep the clause as it is, and that the explanation that was given by the advocate is absolutely acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. We did note that you would not be here this morning. We received your apology, Honourable Elders. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Chair. I just think we should locate where this sits in the Primary Act, which is under application for debt review. That's where this is being added to. Now, what may happen is because you open this up to secured credit, is you could actually undermine the debt review process by having a wide situation like this. And what we should remember is that, you know, unsecured credit and secured credit, by their nature, are against two different goods, if you will. Secured credit is mainly against an asset, a car or a property, and unsecured is for cash. Now, if you start to put the ability for someone to skip debt review, go to a court, and then have the interest, maximum interest, reduced to zero against their asset, I think you create quite a complex problem for secured lenders. And you know, I'm going to use the ANC's terminology that, you know, that they're the party that are interested in the poorest of the poor. And this seems to speak to people way beyond that target group that this bill was originally focused to. And I think that the point made by Ms. Gibson is a good one, that there is no assessment against secured credit. We don't even have the assessment against unsecured credit, so I kind of feel like we're flying blind. Well, I haven't seen the social assessment, the one that this committee requested. And so I think that it is a suggestion made by Ms. Gibson that looks to refocus the bill on the target market, which is the meaner, poorest of the poor, you know, sort of category of people. And so I would certainly support that amendment to only focus in on unsecured credit. And just with relation to that that court case, I actually can't even recall, you know, the person that was going before the court in that case, whether they were looking for a reduction of interest rates, whether it was secured or unsecured credit. I'd just like to know you know, which case that was. Because, you know, at the end of the day, and in our maintained position from the outset, is that you cannot have a bill that creates uncertainty in the credit market that will A, lead to an increase in the cost of credit to the consumer, and B, or both, a restriction of the availability of credit. And I think that this puts a big question mark, certainly over the secured credit market.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Now, I'm not sure, oh yes, Honourable Kacharia, you had your hand up as well.
Thank you, Chair. My colleague has addressed most of my concerns. I just want to strengthen the argument that it would be remiss of us in terms of addressing potential unintended consequences not to avail ourselves of a impact assessment on secured loans. I think that's crucial, and I think we would be very remiss in doing so. And then I want us to take cognizance of Treasury's comment on the fact that where voluntary agreements are in place, we need to be aware of that as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Hadebe.
Honourable Chairperson, I think that if we, this position of this bill as it is, it was proposed by Honourable Mashrofo that it remains it is, and it was supported by Honourable Williams. But what is very important here, this issue is not arbitrary. We know very well that even in the constitution of the country, the final arbiter of any dispute is the court of law. That's it. if there's any dispute anywhere. So I think that in guiding, in giving, in granting the magistrates, they'll be able even to confirm what happens in the tribunal, whatever it might be. So I think that there's no harm in retaining the thing as it is.
Thank you, Honourable Fadevi. My only concern here is our rationale for the bill, which we say a South African natural person, if the insolvency system has remained largely creditor-oriented and excludes the poor from the process, which is contrary to international trends and best practice. There are three statutory measures offering debt relief: sequestration, administration, and debt review. All of these require some form of disposable income or asset. And that is why it differentiates between debtors based on financial grounds. This constitutes unfair discrimination based on socioeconomic status and also undermines the dignity of affected consumers. Furthermore, among consumers who do qualify for one of the alternative debt measures, there are some who are discriminated against as they have no possibility of a discharge, none, the NINA issue. And this also perpetuates then the disadvantaged social position of these consumers as they are in the lower tiers of the economy. These exclusions accordingly affect the equal enjoyment of rights as envisaged in Section 9 and the right to dignity as envisaged in Section 10 of the Constitution. And members, one can go on and on, but perhaps the most important issue is this: that we wanted to target the most vulnerable consumers. And these were excluded by sequestration processes because there was no benefit to creditors. Administration, as they cannot affect the cost of an administrator. Or debt review, because debt counsellors cannot handle this group cost effectively and don't and will not. Now, we cannot forget that rationale. They will not. They won't. That's why such people are losing the little bed that they're sleeping on or mat. The committee consulted extensively and it became clear that in order to make use of the debt review process, Section 86 of the Act, a consumer must earn at least 7,500 currently per month before they'll even be addressed. This amount is only one of the qualifying criteria. And this is why I'm going to exercise my powers as chair and flag this clause. I would like this to be thoroughly addressed by all parties, because I do want it to achieve our intention. But if we flag it, it means we can continue to discuss it until we do clause by clause. Honourable Ms. Norball.
Chairperson, I must thank you for probably trying to read the objects of this piece of amendment. But in as much as we flag this thing, I feel that at all times, we must also remember that this point which we are referring to is a point that was reflected in the diagram in terms of the process map. And you can't, when you look at the process map in terms of the implementation of this legislation, just come at any point. Because with this proposed amendment by Treasurer, we are confusing objects, the definition, but also the dispute making. This is more about process. If you don't go to a magistrate without going to certain processes first, and this clause does not actually replace those criteria and the other things that they must be taken into account, we are arriving at a stage where a decision has to be made because there is no agreement between parties. Therefore, someone must adjudicate. What is the other best mechanism to adjudicate?
I think what one heard, Honourable McLaughlin, when you were sharing this position with us earlier, is your concern, which you put very succinctly, we should not limit the powers of the adjudicator. And I think that that is something that we have to weigh up. What is it saying? But I am also appealing so that I myself am right with all of the honourable members on this one, because I think we are agreeing to something, but there's something we want to be sure of. And so my appeal would be, just flag it, we're not yet going clause by clause, and then I might also be able to see the green light that many of the members of the committee see, if I can appeal to you on that. Thank you. Can we then proceed, Treasury?
Thank you, Chair. Okay, then the next clause then is relating to the requirement of when it opposes, and it says that credit providers must require insurance, consumer credit, and insurance on that credit product. And our concern with this clause is that it is prescribing, it is requiring something in primary law where we don't know the full consequences of what that prescription is. Now, we agree that from what I recall of the discussions, the question was, to the extent that you have insurance in place, you would then be able to rely on that insurance and you would not then need to access the various relief mechanisms. And I think that's a good premise. Or we're not asking that this clause be removed. We are suggesting that you give the minister more flexibility. So rather than state the clause, the obligation in the Act, when the committee and the minister will have to come back to change the Act in order to make any changes to this particular clause, is that we empower the minister to require this and could then give some more flexibility to the minister to maybe tweak that as your experience develops. And so the wording, the drafting that you see is a proposal that would give effect to that empowering provision.
I could see a number of members seem to be agreeing, but let us just succinctly put our position here. Honourable McPherson, followed by Honourable Khadebe.
Yeah, Chair, I have to take responsibility for this for this clause, because this is a clause that I have actually introduced or suggested to the committee. And I think it's important, Ms. Gibson, why I suggested the clause, because I think that this is a way for us to mitigate those that fall into unemployment or disability or something that won't allow them to pay back that money owed to the credit providers, which would limit the use of this bill. Now, the discussion that we've had for a long time has been engaging with industry specialists in the insurance business to understand what does this look like, what does this product look like, what would the costs be, is it expensive, is it cheap, and today I still don't have those answers, and that is problematic, because I sit now trying to defend a proposal that I made, and I cannot now justify that because I've never been given that information. And that is a concerning place for me as a legislator to be when I have to defend this to the public. And I think in concept it is a good idea, it's a sound principle that those that take unsecured credit are protected automatically against the circumstances that they might find themselves in. Now, I don't know where the fault lies. I don't know whether it's a committee fault, whether it's a National Treasury fault, whether it's a DTI fault. The fact is that I don't have the information now to justify this point. And so I think that that what you put before here is actually justified to say that there may be unintended consequences, because you yourself don't know what those unintended consequences are, because you don't have the same information that I require. So, Chair, I look to you as the chair of this committee, because it is something that we as a committee had agreed that we wanted to see and we had wanted to understand, and we don't have that. So I don't know how to apply my mind to this clause and to the point that Ms. Gibson makes.
Right. Well, you've applied yourself very effectively in the past, if I may say so. But I think what this does say is potential. And sometimes, you know, quite frankly, there are a lot of unintended consequences potentially to us having moved to this venue, for example. But let me give all members the opportunity to comment. The Honourable Hadebe had his, you're trying to maybe negotiate there, yeah. Honourable Hadebe, followed by Honourable McLaubel.
No, thank you, Chairperson. I think that the amendment is acceptable on our side.
Yes, sorry, I
understand. Oh, I say that this amendment which the Treasurer is coming with, it will be acceptable if he's going to give the privilege to the Minister himself. Although I don't want to dwell on what Mr. Kofi has just said.
No, because I understood Mr. Williams, Honourable Williams, had indicated when he made a report once that they discussed this on the study group, early subcommittee. Honourable McLaubel?
No, thanks, Chair. I think that our Chief Comrade Kumane has covered me. I think you will want, because there are certain variables when decisions have to be made. Therefore, the question of mail and taking into consideration that decisions that have an impact, automatically they will have a discussion, those whoever were ministers. I think from the spirit of the Act, that amendment should be supported. But what Honourable Matheson is raising are the modalities on how these decisions are arrived at. And the organizations or ministers or executing authorities, they will always have instruments. For an example, if this legislation was driven by the executive not being a committee bill, the executive would have done socio-economic impact assessment, which is slightly different because of the technical capacity we possess as different arms. But in terms of the spirit of the bill, it's just a technical amendment, it's not fundamental,
no.
It should be supported. But the point that is being raised is to say what then becomes the mechanics that that flexibility does not get to be probably abused. And those are some of the things that whenever we put legislation, what then becomes our own mechanics as legislators to provide oversight, so that there are no unintended consequences in the process. But as Comrade Kumane has proposed, I support him.
Thank you very much, Honourable McLaubel. Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I'm covered. Thank you.
Yes, you really are economic with words. Thank you. Advocate Van der Merwe.
Chair, I didn't have anything to add. I would just like to confirm. Apologies.
Very heavy chair with Chinese characteristics from Pumala.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to confirm. I do not have anything to add. It is totally a policy decision. I just want to confirm that in Agri we will have to just amend this clause to reflect the proposed amendment.
look as if it is a small amendment here. Am I right? One or two words. And I see DTI nodding vigorously there. I take that to mean yes. DTI?
Yeah, I think it does not change the fact that there is a need for the credit life insurance and the fact that the departments may need to consult to work around this. There is a need for this product in the market. So, yeah, I think the proposal by Treasury can be accommodated. It creates a flexibility and it doesn't take the crux of what this clause is about.
Thank you very much. Can we then move Treasury?
Okay, the next one is an easy one, Chair. So it's now, it relates to still that same section 106B, but because now we've made it an empowering provision rather than a direct obligation, subclause B there, where it says the Minister must, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, describe the limit in respect to the cost of credit, the cost of that credit life insurance, we would then need to reference for a regulation issued in terms of that subsection, we can then set a cap. You'll see that in terms of the proposals here, there was a question mark from outside around whether it should be credit life insurance specifically or credit insurance, but in our discussions with the DTI advocate, they confirmed that actually that was a determined position that it should be limited to credit life. So I just want to confirm that that is the case, because I proposed that it just referred to credit insurance in general. So my crossing out of life thing should just be within that context.
I'm glad that there was this discussion between our experts here on the left. Let us turn to the committee. Honourable Ms. Lobo.
I think, Chairperson, that one is affected by the first one.
Yeah.
Therefore, it becomes a mutatis mutandis. I do agree that probably what Treasury is proposing to say it should be a credit insurance. Immediately you say life. You know, the life insurance is, and the onerous requirement it places, and the exclusion that happens to a number of people for various reasons. I'm happy for the fact that you have inserted the word regulation. Regulation, very important, because they give a clear mechanism on how the implementation will look like. And at least it does. Well, with respect to clause 29, I don't think it has an impact whether to delete or not to delete. Really, we can't be saving time.
Yeah.
But more importantly, it's something that has to happen. It has to happen. Let me be there, there's no harm. It does. Because all those matters, you know that have implication around concurrences or just section things. It looks like tautology, but it's okay. No one is harmed. But the main draft, which is your 106B, the A and B, I think it suffices.
Thank you, Honourable McLobo. Honourable McPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I said it must be credit life insurance, Ms. Gibson. Why must be credit life insurance and not credit insurance? Because credit life insurance covers death, disability, unemployment. So it must encompass all of those. Because I also know that credit life insurance covers, I think, 6 months of unemployment. It also covers disability, loss of income, etc. So it's an encompassing product that covers all of those situations.
Now, I'm not in the insurance industry myself, so I just need somewhat of a clarification there. If what you're saying is technically correct, and as I say, I'm not in that industry, then what does credit insurance mean? Honourable McPherson? I thought you were, you're so knowledgeable there. But let's turn to, yes, Ms. Gibson.
That specific point. So your, if it was to credit insurance, it would be to life and non-life. So in other words, it could be your phone gets stolen, for example. So it's more general. So credit insurance is wider. If you specify life, then it's this life category. So then you have to have that particular type of insurance. Now I understand the point that you've made. I suppose the question then is, for someone who has their phone, and I'm using phone, but it could be something more meaty. It could be your whatever it is that you've taken credit out for. The fact that it gets stolen, if you don't have insurance, like say theft insurance, you still have to carry on paying it. So the question then is, I don't have a fixed view on this, I think this is for the committee to be thinking around, are you only wanting to protect against those life events versus non-life events, which could still have an impact? Now, I think you might be able to kick this one into touch, depending, because if you do agree to make it by regulation, you could actually then give the minister the power to also then be saying exactly which kind of, and you would have the flexibility to then be saying which buckets of insurance. But I think maybe it is that you specifically want life insurance, in which case you should then state it in this clause.
I'm wondering if retrenchment is covered by losing my life. Anyway, Honourable McLaughlin.
I think, Chair, one of the things that we always do as legislators is to be on the side of the people. You don't put things that become a limitation. Insurance, by its own definition, is to insure, guarantee. And it takes different forms, like she explained. Unless the issue here is not about, because remember this legislation, it looks at various types of instances where you become indebted or become insolvent. And these items are not the same. Therefore, the broader definition it has. But ultimately, whoever makes the decision must be able to say, is the insurance sufficient for the value of the product if anything happens, in terms of that insurance will be able to kick in and be able to sufficiently be able not to expose the credit. Therefore, the definition to that it should be a credit insurance, it suffices and is something that is already applicable now. It doesn't pose its limitations.
Honourable MacPherson, followed by the Honourable Williams. And then I'll just can you hear now?
Yes.
As I was saying, the advocate Van der Merwe, who indicated she wished to speak, she would be able to do so after members have spoken.
Thank you. I tell you, Ms. Gibson, why I don't think it can be credit insurance. Because credit insurance, as you just said now, let's say it was a phone. I'm not sure that it's right for credit providers to start insuring what people do with that credit. They can only insure the amount that they lend. They cannot insure the asset or product that someone goes and buys with it. So that's why it cannot be credit insurance. It can only be a credit life insurance product that protects the consumer to pay back the credit provider. What they do with that unsecured credit is completely their responsibility. But we cannot then pass what they do with it onto the credit provider.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the intent of the legislation or this particular clause is to protect, like Honourable MacPherson said, the actual life of the credit given, not the product. Because I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that the poorest of the poor are running around buying cell phones. I think they're more likely to be buying food on credit. So I think that it's the credit itself that we're insuring in this clause, not the product that was bought with the credit. And I don't think we should confuse the two. We're not, because if the individual wants to insure their products, then they can. But the people we're protecting, we can't compel them to have now credit life insurance on the credit, and then also insurance on the product. And I don't think that we should mix the two together. So we should keep it that it's the what we're insuring, and the intent of this clause is to insure the actual credit amount. So if that person can no longer pay because of circumstances, then that insurance will kick in and cover that debt. That's why that bill is there, not for the pro. Thank you.
No, I think although it was explained differently, it had the same intention, but I did see the Honourable Elvis. I wasn't sure because you were sort of... if you could go ahead.
No, I do agree. It's the capital amount that's lent out that must be insured and not the product itself. The individual can take out separate insurance per product. That is separate personal preference and issue, the decision they take. But this must be related to the actual capital amount.
Yeah. Right. Now, you would have taken those views into account, Ms. Gibson, but let me, and I'll come back to you, but Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chairperson. There was just actually another aspect that I just wanted to clarify. The proposal from Treasury on the slide 5 indicates, so if we now agree we're going to give the Minister the discretion to make regulations, it says this must be in consultation with the Minister of Finance. So the committee needs to also just make a decision on that, because in consultation means that Minister of Finance must agree. Now, we already have in our bill that the actual rate, that is in consultation with the Minister of Finance. So that is on page 15 of the bill, line 10. Of the bill, line 10. So if the committee is of the view that, look, this is something where you want that agreement with Minister of Finance, Minister of Trade, because you are talking here about insurance products, and insurance falls under Minister of Finance, then it must be in consultation. But if the committee says, no, what we are talking about here is we want the minister to be able to create something, perhaps he must consult with Finance, but he doesn't have to have the agreement. If he wants to say this is a requirement, he must be able to do so. But we do say that he must have the agreement of the Minister of Finance on the limits that are set for the product. So I just need the committee to consider that and give me inputs on that.
I'm going to take most, you know, the entities here first, and then members can come back. Yes, the National Credit Regulator, Ms. Montagari.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I just wanted to talk to the issue of credit life insurance. You will recall that for the first time we introduced, or the committee introduced a cap on credit life insurance, and the Minister of Trade and Industry had to consult Minister of Finance, because insurance generally falls under National Treasury. Thank you.
I thought you would also comment then on some of the issues that have come out, no, needn't be life, let's make it credit insurance. And I just asked you to comment, and I thought you may have also commented on that. But I see Mr. Sipa Mandla Kumkani has his hand up.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I would like to align myself with what Honourable McPherson and Honourable Albert were saying. Just also to remind the committee and take the committee back to the reason why we had this provision. When somebody gets into a credit provider environment and is looking for credit, he gets that credit, but in order for that person to ensure that he keeps, you know, maintaining the payments and all of that, I mean, the reason why we have credit life insurance is for the purpose of ensuring that in the event that you die, then the credit life insurance can kick in. In the event that you get disabled or you get retrenched, even the National Credit Amendment Act of 2014, it indicates that the cost of credit includes the following, which is your interest, your initiation fee, your service fee, and credit life insurance. So the National Credit Amendment Act didn't give a wider scope in terms of any other insurance, which might include, I mean, products. You are not actually insuring products. You are actually ensuring the credit that you have actually taken, and to ensure that it gets to be paid. In the event that you die, you get retrenched, you get disabled. So and if now we were to broaden it up, we will actually be saying the very same section 106, which focuses on the consultation around credit life insurance as a product for consumers. Now it should actually sort of include a broader scope of credit insurance, which is not what is intended in terms of that particular environment. So, but what I was trying to say is just to clarify that the issue here is all about credit life insurance as opposed to credit insurance as in general. If your phone gets stolen, I mean, you can get an insurance elsewhere, but it has nothing to do with, it's not like in the ordinary course of...
I think we've got you. Let me just answer this very clearly, Mr. Kulkarni. Are you saying that the credit life insurance under the Principal Act directly addresses retrenchment and unemployment?
Yes.
So it actually says if you become unemployed, that qualifies under life insurance.
Yes. And to take it further...
I haven't seen that myself, so that's why I'm asking you.
And to take it further, Chair, the reason why we came up with this particular provision, it was to say the targeted group of 7,500 limit, those are the people who, in the normal course of events, they are not even aware that they have taken credit life insurance. If they know, they are not even being told that they can claim, you know. And we said for them to be covered, whether they are aware or they are not aware, but if we make it mandatory, then it will actually then ensure that there are no unintended consequences in as far as consumers is concerned, knowing or not knowing. That's what I'm...
Right. Let me just take Professor Maseko there.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings again to the House. Chair, my understanding is that credit life insurance is talking about the life of the credit, not the life of the person, not even the life of the product that has been purchased under that credit agreement. So it's the life of the credit agreement. If that credit gets paid off, that insurance policy should lapse because it's no longer covering anything. So if we start from that and then map that to the life, non-life that Treasury was exploring, we would realize that when you cover this type of credit life, the clauses in the policy will indicate what it is covering. I don't think there's a generic term for all policies, because all policies are not defined by law. They are defined almost contractually between the insurer and the insured. So each policy will speak for itself as to what it covers. But if in there it says also we cover against death, that's when it will then have a life component of the person in it. But the starting point that we should be aware of is that this is the credit life, the life of the credit. That's the first starting point.
I think that's a very clear point. Now, that hasn't been underlined in that manner before or emphasized, and perhaps it would have been helpful if we'd heard that earlier. Honourable Williams?
Chairperson, can we go back to the Clause 19 amendment that's been suggested by Treasury? The reason I say that is we're talking about credit life insurance and life insurance, but I'd like for the advocate Funamoma to just tell us the implications of this amendment, because I think that would give us some more, if it's just a technical amendment, then fine, but if there are implications then I'd like to know what those implications are before we make a decision on this amendment. Thank you.
But you're not saying go back specifically on the life aspect, but right, okay. On Advocate van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. If I can just make one, if you would allow me just to make one point on life versus insurance. Our Act defines both. So credit insurance also includes a credit life insurance. So when we talk about credit insurance, it includes credit life insurance. But it also includes an agreement covering loss or damage to property, loss or theft of an access card, personal information number, or similar device, or loss or theft of credit confidential to a loss or theft of your loss of your access card and so on. Whereas credit life insurance is defined as including cover payable in the event of a consumer's death, disability, terminal illness, unemployment, or other insurable risk that is likely to impair the consumer's ability to earn an income or meet the obligations under a credit agreement. And I think, if I recall correctly, that is why we highlighted credit life insurance. This is what the committee wanted to target. In respect of the change, members will also remember that we have specifically made our bill, our commencement clause, as being not operational immediately upon publication. The minister will, how it works in practice is that the minister is in discussions with the presidency, and the president promulgates when the act actually becomes operational. So once this bill is passed through the parliamentary process, it, we hope, will be signed off by the president and it will become an act, but it will not immediately be operational. So the idea for that was, first off, to give the NCR the opportunity to get these systems in place before that comes into place, but then also the idea was that this specific clause could be delayed in becoming operational until these measures were in place. So the committee from the outset recognized that there might be things that have to happen before this clause becomes operational. To say that this, what we have here, can now be done through regulations that the minister will make.
Revelations or resolutions?
Regulations. Apologies, Chair, I'm fighting a bit of a cold here, so I might start sounding funny. I'll try and speak as clearly as possible. So to say that the minister can bring this this concept into being through regulations will in fact have the same effect. In other words, whether the minister will be in discussion with the presidency to bring it into operation at a later stage or to do it through regulations will have the same effect. The only issue that I'm not certain about is whether the committee would like these regulations to be in with the agreement of the Minister of Finance. I think that for me is the one outstanding point.
Never been one for detail. Right, Honourable McLaughlin.
No, thanks, Chair. I think the advocate has made a clarification. If you read that section, there is an 8A and a B. And if you check the other one, the first one, it refers to credit insurance a credit provider may charge to a consumer. And it should just be read as such in the Principal Act, because the Principal Act is very clear what does it say. And then secondly, immediately you bring the life insurance, probably for treasurer's knowledge. There is also a different thing that they are referring to, the one that is in the Principal Act, which is more specifically to say, then if you speak about the person. Therefore, the consultation through you, Chair, Advocate, is important because all matters that are related to monetary issues, the custodian in terms of the Republic and in terms of our Constitution, the Minister of Finance must have views and say you are not disrupting. Consultation doesn't mean like approve, but it means they come to an agreement because they look at other implications to say what are these other things that directly or indirectly gets affected. I think you can be able to make that necessary amendment, but if you read the spirit of A and the spirit of B, it should never be read outside the main principle, that's what it means. But the most important issue is to say, how do we explain these things? You know, someone is just, we are reading like we are doing linear reading. You might even say, but these people, what are they trying to say? On A, they are saying credit insurance, which is broad, very broad. And clearly defined like a Comrade Pungano we're looking here. Then there is this specificity, certain circumstances that you wanted to provide for. I think, Chair, thanks for those notes because they are actually very helpful. But imagine that it's a very good confusion. It then starts to say, during the course of implementation, or during the course of people using this as a tool, how do you ensure that the nation, those who are meant for it, are properly made aware, they are conscientized, so that they can be able to use this particular instrument? Imagine if the legislators, they speak different languages on this matter. And while you are in the same writing, but the context might slightly mean different things depending where what's your prism of reference.
I think, Honourable Ms. Lobo, what I'd like to hear after, you know, the exposition you've provided is what then are you agreeing with or disagreeing? Are you suggesting that what Treasury has put here should, you know, remain as maintain credit insurance, or should it go back to credit life? I think I would like that clear, because at one point we were saying, no, let's maintain credit insurance, and we were all agreeing, or many of us were. So I want to get that clear and come to Honourable Khadebe. Thank you.
No, thanks, Chair. After the explanation even by the professor there, at least the context in which we need to read is clarified, because if we're reading outside context, it's a problem. Therefore, the amendment is correct where it insists for regulation to be issued is correct, but where you have deleted the life must remain, as in the original document we have here.
Yes, I have recognized your hand, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Khadebe was earlier, so I'm recognizing him to take the floor, and then yourself.
Yes, Comrade Chairperson, we are making an amendment to the National Credit Act, of which the credit insurance has been defined. It has been defined, and part of the definition of that is that credit insurance means an agreement between an insurer on one hand and a credit provider or consumer on what mode on the other hand, in terms of which the insurer agrees to pay benefits upon the occurrence of a specified contingency, primarily for the purpose of satisfying all or part of the consumer's liability to the credit provider under a credit agreement at the time that a specified contingency occurs. That includes one, a credit life insurance agreement. That is, a credit life insurance agreement is within this credit life. And number two, an agreement covering the loss or damage to a property, or an agreement covering loss or theft of an access card, personal information, or a similar device. Any loss or theft of credit, consequential to a loss of theft or contemplated by that. But it goes further to define what credit life is. Credit life includes cover payable in the event of the consumer's death, disability, terminal illness, unemployment, or other insurable risk that is likely to impair the consumer's ability to earn an income or meet obligation under the credit agreement.
That's principal act.
Yeah, that's the principal act. So when coming to this definition of the fee, why does it have to deviate from that one of the main act?
So thank you. Yeah, no, we can return that. Honourable Macpherson?
Thanks. I'm going to be leaving now, so I just want to say that it should remain credit life insurance, and I believe that the Minister of Finance should still be consulted because it is an insurance product which falls under that department.
I think everyone is in agreement, I think, with the Minister of Finance being consulted, am I right? And the issue was in or is it after?
After, it means that he can consult, but this was made by another donation.
I think just a caution here for one moment, but let me allow Honourable Matlobo.
No, thanks. I think probably the lawyers must help us here. I don't, you know, the more we discuss this thing, the more it causes problems. There is an issue, advocate, through you, Chair. Why do we need B? Because the A is sufficient. Because you see, if you look at the A, the A look at broader definition to say there has to be a limit that is described for the credit insurance. The Principal Act does specify what it says. Why on B, when now that limit is, because B to me, it's just a process. How do you arrive at a limit? You can only arrive at the limit by doing a regulation. And why does the principal theme now, there is an insertion of credit life? Because remember, A must be read with B. And there is a discharge. That's why we spend more minutes causing confusion. But for the implementation of the directive in A, a process should be undertaken by the Minister of Trade and Industry to give the limits, do regulations in consultation or after, it doesn't matter, whatever language you use, but because it's how many matters are being dealt with. But by the insertion of that word to repeat this thing of limits, credit life, we have just caused an unnecessary, that's what the chief would say. I think we should not have gone, we should have actually retained the same wording if it's an A, unless we are meaning two things in subsection 8 A and B. Can you see that reading? Poses a dilemma. That's why I was saying that legislators were speaking different languages. But if the trigger is A, therefore everything that is in B must be the same, except that B is just to say let's elucidate a process point.
Honourable Williams, I'm not sure if I saw your hand here or not. Yes.
Chair, I was just going to talk on the matter of whether it should read in or after consultation. So I say after consultation. So we should have it not in consultation, it should be after consultation. I'd like to propose that. Thank you.
Well, the only point I would like to have considered, we can turn to the advocates in this regard and the Ms. Gibson from Treasury. Understood financial issues required the Minister of Finance's concurrence, and therefore it should be in. No, I'm just saying that was my own understanding. So I would like to go to the advocate Van der Merwe and then Ms. Gibson on this.
Thank you, Chair. It is not something that I can advise the committee which one to go with or which one not to go with. In consultation would mean that the Minister of Finance's agreement must be obtained before the Minister of Trade can prescribe this requirement. If it is after consultation, Minister of Finance will still be consulted, has to be consulted by Minister of Trade, but if they do not agree, then the Minister of Trade can still proceed and make the regulation. With respect to 8, which is on page subsection 8, which is on page 15, from line 6, depending on what the committee decided, if it has to be a discretion, B will also have to become may. The reason why B reads must, and in fact this is a bit of a drafting technicality, because A and B are very separate paragraphs. Because there's no introductory sentence, they actually don't read together. They deal with two separate issues. So the B of subsection 8 has a must, because we have already made provision for the credit life to be mandatory, and then we needed the minister to prescribe. We couldn't allow a discretion. The minister had to prescribe, so that's why there's a must. But if we now make it a may, the minister may prescribe that there is this mandatory requirement, then 8B will also have to be changed, so that it reads may. But that would be a consequential amendment. So just in short, it is going to be the decision of the committee whether we would like the Minister of Finance to agree. Practically speaking, if the Minister of Finance doesn't agree, but he must be consulted on the limit, he can just say, I'm not going to give you a limit because I don't agree about this measure. So practically, in consultation would probably make sense. But it's still, after consultation, still gives a bit more, if I can call it a power, to the Minister of Trade.
Members, I'm just looking back at my page 15 here of the latest one we've got. We've already made some reference to that already today. Remember the cost of credit, the cost. Now I'm just trying to clarify. In this point here, we're dealing with two issues, you see. One seems to be the cost of it, and the other is the principle. So I don't want to see this conflated. So that's where my concern is, trying to clarify myself. Honourable McLaughlin?
I think, Chairperson, with the clarity and other things that have been said, that use of the word life on B is not correct. It's not correct because A and B are read together. That's one. The issue that the advocate chair is referring to now, that one advocate is a matter of how do you put it. This assumption to say the Minister of Finance has a veto power, they might not agree. There is always a dispute resolution mechanism if ministers don't agree. It is a norm in the executive. If they don't agree or they can't find each other, but the little experience one spends there, they will always agree because they act in the best interest of the advice that gets to be given. But if they don't agree, it doesn't mean the other one goes ahead. That's not how the executive, in terms of the constitution and in the law that governs the executive, I don't think we should be worried about that one. But what is most important is the principle of the constitution and other related legislation. Any money matter related, or any power that you want to exercise, a fiduciary responsibility given by any legislation, you will never exercise it in isolation to consult. The consultation is a thin thread that binds certain fiduciary responsibilities that are there. But the issue that I thought was what I was asking is to say, how do you read A and B? But I think I'm clear now in my mind that B is clarifying a process. Therefore, the insertion of the word life is not actually, it creates an anomaly to what is being said in A. Therefore, the word life will be taken out. But I think the treasury and the advocate, they can be in a position to put the right wording, whether it's in consultation or after, but the principle that you can't actually conclude your own processes without consulting.
Yes. Honourable Mantash?
Chairperson, I agree that consultation is sacrosanct.
But I appeal to members that we don't remove the light in that space, because it will lose the meaning of what we're trying to do.
I'm going to be coming over here. Ms. Gibson wanted to address us earlier on the matter, but I also want to align myself to the sentiment or the principle that the Honourable Mantashe is tabling here. In the Principal Act, it's much clearer that this life refers not to the person's life, but the life of the credit itself, which then, you know, does really clarify matters for me. I do notice, though, that even on page 15, when it talks of cost of credit insurance, it doesn't have cost of credit life insurance. And I note in the Principal Act, there is credit insurance and there's credit life insurance. So I just want to ensure through the advocate Van der Merwe that we are not overlooking certain essentialities that should be here. Having said that, Ms. Gibson, would you come in, followed by the DTI?
Thank you, Chair. So I agree that A and B are useful to read together, and because of that, B, notwithstanding my proposal to delete life insurance, it is probably better to keep life insurance in that clause. Because what the first part is doing is it's saying you may set the credit cap. Then you're going, and that's for all of the credit. That's for life and non-life. Then, because we've got additional requirements with respect to what we've identified, what I understand has been identified as a category which is absolutely essential to protect consumers, which is a subcategory of the wider. That's the life that we then create, or would be proposed. You're creating an empowering provision for the minister to set additional requirements in relation to that particular category. And so what B is doing, what the HB is then doing, is it's connecting to that new empowering provision to say that to the extent the minister does issue these requirements relating to this category, which is life, you must in that instance, and that's where the may and the must becomes important, because now the minister must set that as opposed to the may, so it's a further timing. I think from our side, it goes without saying that we, to the extent that there are matters that deal with insurance, that is the jurisdiction of the Minister of Finance, and so we believe it should be in consultation.
Yes.
I'm assuming we're not moving on to the next clause.
Yes, no, it was just that point that I know you wish to comment on immediately. Yes, DTI, Dr. Masoncha.
Thank you, Chair. My understanding on the in-consultation and after-consultation is that in both instances there's a need for a consultation. And I think that for the sake of flexibility and making sure that there's always service delivery taking place, I would recommend that we look at after-consultation.
I'm looking at members. Honourable Kacharya.
I think it's important that we retain the phraseology as in consultation for the reasons advanced by the Honourable Shobo earlier, which I fully.
Can someone just lend me that Principal Act for a moment? I know I had it and then I just, well, it's not mine, it's Ms. Sheldon's. Because this is 106B, is it? I'm going to just check it. That's the one that's in consultation here. So I'm just looking it up here, 106B. or maybe 106B was added. There's 106, all right. And then there's the B, which is right. But there was, it's new, this particular one. Is that correct, Advocate Van der Merwe? Yes.
No, it states
very specifically new section. I'm actually asking you to assist me with Advocate Van der Merwe. Earlier on, I found the phrase in consultation with the Minister of Finance with respect to credit life insurance. And I found that in the Principal Act. I would like that to be located for me. Because I don't want, if the Principal Act is saying this, and we're now amending this somewhere else, it's not going to be in alignment. Honourable McLaughlin.
I think, Chairperson, you've guided us. The legal team will just try to find it, because when we come back, let's flag this point. It's more about which is the right language. And I don't want to assume, but I know that it's mostly the way it's used is always in consultation. But let's be definitive that what is that we are more aligned. And then let's allow them that when we convene again, let them just help us to use the right terminology. But the last point that Ms. Gibson has raised, I think it's a further point that we need to be able to flag. Yeah. Let's not conclude it. The problem if we try to conclude it, one of the things I'm so scared of is how it's going to get to be getting different interpretations.
Yeah.
If ourselves we give different interpretation, imagine the complication when we start to do an application. Let's flag it. Whether it's credit life or is it credit insurance, and allow us to do further consultation and advice on the matter, and then we'll conclude.
Right. We simply would not like to confuse anyone implementing this act, and that is important. All right. Now, I'm looking to the left. I did see a hand at one point. I'm not sure if it was yours. Thank you, Advocate.
Chair, just to clarify, the in consultation is in the section. That is where it is, section subsection 8, where it speaks about the limits must be in consultation with the Minister of Finance. In consultation is actually not that regularly used because it does limit the power of the minister. So the reason why it is used here in consultation with the Minister of Finance is because what the Minister of Trade and Industry is prescribing affects an industry that is administered by the Minister of Finance, which is insurance. So that is why this specific clause about the limit in respect of the cost speaks about in consultation. And the actual fact of requiring credit life insurance to be a product for a credit agreement, that could fall squarely within credit, which falls under the Minister of Trade and Industry. So that is the kind of thing that the committee could look at. But Chair, I must be honest, I would not feel comfortable to decide about in or after. I can explain to you what the difference is and how it would affect, but it is a policy decision because it has policy implications.
Now, look, thank you for that. I think all of us have realized that, one or two words really adds to our challenges here. Just the word life has kept us going for over an hour. And now we come to the in and after, and I think you've got a very pertinent point there, Advocate, that the one area, credit, is within the mandate of trade and industry. On the other hand, when you're looking at, how did you put it?
The insurance industry falls under the Minister of
the insurance industry is not under trade an industry that you are. So I think we've got to be careful. This is not being tautologous at all. It's referring to different things and different mandates here. So this is helping, I think, all of us. I know it's been a long day, but it's still fairly short in the afternoon, right? So if we, you know, see people stretching, getting some oxygen and one thing and another. Right. Do you wish to comment on anything at this point, DTI? All right. Now, you realize we were at a point where we were going through what Treasury had said and we'd come back on certain issues. We did flag one or two, and I'm just looking in the light of further discussions that we have had. Let me look towards the whip and ask the Honourable Khadebe. I earlier appealed to the committee to flag something. Do we want to move on it, or rather keep it flagged till tomorrow? Honourable Khadebe?
Yes, let's flag it, because I don't think that will come to any other positions.
Now, that being the case, exactly where are we with things? Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So it's Ms. Gibson now. Yes. Thank you, Ms. Gibson. We're all agreed it is you.
Thank you, Chair. So, just before the last one, I just wanted to check on, I know there was some discussion on it, clause 29, and this relates to funding for financial literacy. And the concern here is that whenever there is funding for anything, there is a very strict, prescribed, lengthy, laborious process, correctly, which has to be followed. And so the concern with putting this in is it suggests that there might be something else that you should be doing that might be in parallel or sideline and doesn't take into account the fact that there is already this extensive process. So I take the point that it's not egregious, and yes, you would consult the Minister of Finance, but it possibly looks like we might be trying to bypass or go around what our existing constitutional process.
Right.
Maybe I should just finish to the end and then...
Yes, we can put out here.
Thank you, Chair. Then on clause 29B, which amends the sections 171-2A, and this in effect is talking about how the thresholds can be amended. So the thresholds relating to who qualifies as a debt intervention applicant and what qualifies in terms of the amount of unsecured debt. And just to say, we agree with this all in principle, so it's not the principle we're disagreeing with. It's a language issue that currently it talks about after having considered inflation, what are the other ones? I think it's got to when debt review, you could qualify for debt review, etc. There are three components to it, inflation being one. And our proposal is that, so we there was, from our side, we had a discussion around the legal technicality of what it meant by saying, after having considered the following factors. And some lawyers said it means you must only consider those factors. In other words, the minister must only consider those factors. Other lawyers said, no, there's a slight gap there that it's implied, but it could be interpreted that there may be other factors to be considered. So our proposal there is just to make it clear. Our understanding is that those were the three factors which needed to be considered, and therefore we proposed adding in the word having considered only the following factors. And then the last proposal relates to, given the importance of these thresholds, that they can potentially change the category of people that we're trying to reach. So as again we've been talking about, this is intended to reach the poorest of the poor, the no income, no assets. We agree completely that those thresholds over time will naturally change, and we shouldn't be forcing people out of the category just because there's inflation, for example. And so suddenly you might be earning 8,000 Rand, but actually last year you were earning 7,500, therefore last year you would have qualified, but this year you don't. So we agree with that principle that these thresholds need to be adjusted. The question, and that's why we have said we believe that it needs to be clear that they're adjusted specifically taking into account those factors which you've determined. And then secondly, that there is consultation provided for in terms of what the ultimate. So you'll see that this is an after consultation with relevant stakeholders. It's not an in consultation. So by no means is it suggesting that you need to have agreement with the people that that will be affected by this.
Yes, I think that certainly would be an agreement with our intention to take inflation, etc., into account. But let us go to the first issue you spoke about, which was the financial literacy program, clause 29. Are we all there?
Yeah.
Right. Now, let's get your views on this, members, now that we've all found the place. Yeah, I mean, I hear little murmurings, but nothing on the mic.
The way it only looks innocent, it's okay. Because it's more of a definition that it's a limited process that is defined.
Thank you, Honourable McLaughlin, Honourable Mantash, Honourable Williams.
Chair, may I request Treasurer to repeat the question on financing the literacy? Can Treasurer repeat what she said on financing of the literacy program? So that I can clarify what she really saying.
We will get that.
I'll talk thereafter.
Let us get that. I'll just hear Honourable Williams and then we'll go back to you, Treasury.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm not happy with only. I think it limits...
Remember, I said let's go back to where Treasury began, which is clause 29. Is only there? No. Where? Not the financial literacy. We started with financial literacy, members, slide 6. I don't see only there. I really don't. Yeah, it's only we share each other's brains, right? Honourable Miss Gibson.
In terms of the provision, it's talking about how It's talking about how the financial literacy program which is provided for will be funded.
Yeah.
And so when you read this, it's saying, well, I mean, I suppose there's a question around whether it means you will discuss with the Minister of Finance based on your existing budget that you're going to use part of it for financial education, financial literacy, versus the formal process that must be followed in terms of obtaining your overall funding for your budget in the first instance. Now, because of that, to the extent that any department is wanting to obtain budget, it has to go through a heavily prescribed process.
And the question then is to have they must consult the Minister of Finance if you're talking about actually separate funding of the program, distinct from what your regular budget is. Is it can't just be you can't just come and talk to the Minister of Finance. It actually has to follow a much longer prescribed process, which is prescribed in law in its own set of rules.
What you're saying is normally this would be you would do this, every department, every minister would cost out the program and then finally put together this global budget for the department. And then that goes through a more streamlined process. However, if you go, as it were, separately outside of that process, this is what this is referring to, and to say, must consult on this. I don't know if that's helpful, Honourable Montash, for you to refer to and comment.
Yes, her response is relevant, and I want us to go back to the presentation by DTI on the 1st of August, wherein they explain clearly how these funds will be scratched from all over. They mentioned many scenarios. And for me, I got comfort because this bill has not been enacted yet. So there's still time to, if there's a portion that they will need from their budget, they still have to budget for that financial, and that bill has been enacted already. So, but besides one thing, they would ask for new treasury. There's another way that they said they would look after, and they mentioned them on page. I think it's the last slide or second last slide that. It is envisaged that an estimated amount of 47 million will be required to successfully implement the prescribed financial literacy training. And this amount can be funded from the following financial resources, which has been researched as far as we are concerned. One is PDA interest, two is the increase in registration fee, and third is the increase in the DJI allocation. So for us, we are comfortable. I don't think this funding issue may be something that may hinder us from forging ahead with this bill, chairperson of the committee. Because for us, this is life and death in the committee. Thank you.
No, thank you, Honourable Montash. Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, I just want some clarity. So on this. So if we did leave it to say must consult the Minister of Finance, this would be unique. I'm asking Treasury this question. Would this be a unique time where finances was sought in this manner, other than the normal way that you normally talk about? So if we left it in, we didn't delete that, would that be a unique, would it be the first time it's ever happened? I just want to know, that's all I want to know, before I make more input. Thank you.
I also want to remind members, there is a process called the appropriation adjustment. And that's the unique time. But Treasury?
Okay, so I think, I cannot say whether it's completely unique or not. I think the distinction comes as if, I mean, and to your point, Chair, if this is something where you're needing additional budget as the DTI, that has to go through the formal process because it's coming off the national budget, as it were. In which case, yes, you would definitely need to consult the Minister of Finance, but there's a whole lot of other process there's a formal process that needs to be followed and happens every year. If, however, it's existing budget that the DTI has, which I think I'm understanding is what's intended, so you are going to be drawing on, you're reallocating your existing funds. So you're not actually asking for additional money from the fiscus in order to do this. You're reallocating money from elsewhere. I'm sure that happens all the time. And then in terms of whether you have to consult the Minister of Finance in that, when I don't actually know the specifics of how it happens in terms of your own personal budget reallocation.
I do need to remind everyone though, that perhaps some sort of uniqueness may come into it. Sorry, Honourable Pacharya, when you realise that this bill did not come from the executive. Therefore, when the executive was budgeting 2 years ago, you know, the 3-year medium term sort of policy budget, etc., proposals, they didn't have this bill. This is a committee bill. All right? And then that being the case, we're pushing this through, and they would clearly not have budgeted it in the last MTEF, that's all I'm saying. So the first time they would be able to get money for it in the normal appropriation processes would be the adjustments, that this has been passed by Parliament, it's a committee bill, and we don't have the funds for X. So, Honourable Kacharya.
Thank you. I understand the distinction between additional budget, because that's clear, the process is unaided or you need to follow that, and the difference between that and dealing with existing funds, as it were, and I completely concur there. The question I want to ask is, if we are legislating for the augmentation of those existing funds from outside sources, whose assent is required? Because I think that's what the intention that Honourable Mantash was referring to. So I'd like some clarity on that, because that's pertinent.
Thank you, Honourable Kichania. Honourable Maslomo.
Well, Chair, my understanding is that when it comes to matters of implementation, remember, even if it's a committee bill, we're doing it not alone. There is an involvement of the public, there is an involvement of the relevant departments. That's why we are sitting here. Even from a planning point of view, these issues start to be factored in. And remember what we're doing here, this amendment, is an intervention on the existing system. There are people who are actually more vulnerable in plight. Therefore, there is some capacity and resources. Some of the resources are being mentioned where they can be found in the short term. But then, depending on the rollout, then you'll factor in these other processes. But the processes on how budgets are obtained, there is no new legislation that can change the existing process. That existing process still has to be followed through. We're not going to legislate new powers that are going to undermine existing methods on how to deal with certain issues. Remember, there are only few departments where in the Constitution is explicit to say what is their role. One of them is National Treasury. Therefore, those processes, they are not under threat or any way. Let alone these other issues that have all the legislation that we've ever passed, whether driven by the executive or driven by the legislature, have we always put adequate resources for implementation? Is something else that probably even the review that was done by the former president, let's read that report, what does it say? Because there's a lot you can find there. But on this one, it's a specific intervention, long overdue. Minimum resources with a degree of comfort that what has been explained by the implementing arms or the implementing agents, that there is going to be an ability to implement. But if additional resources are required, they will follow the process so that at least the effective date of implementation and the synchronization of the other processes that can give them additional resources, they don't miss that process.
Thank you. Look, I think that we have all had the opportunity to share our views on that point of the how will we fund this, do we need to consult the Minister of Finance with respect to financial literacy. I would just like your final comment, Honourable Mantash.
I would just
appreciate your final comment on this. You know, you raised your concern, a number of views have been put on the table, What's your position now with respect to this? Are you still saying, for example, that no, notwithstanding budget processes, etc., I want this to remain? Where are you in relation to this?
Chair, I strongly request that this remains as it is, and aligning myself with what Honourable Mashaba was saying now. And we agree with Treasury to support us. Because for us, this is not going to be implemented tomorrow. Even the bill itself says, after it has been agreed to, there's a specific time that is allowed for the department to plan properly to implement the bill. Thank you.
So, I'm not sure if I see the
Skipson's hand, but I also need to be sure as clear as chair myself where we are, because on the one hand, I may have misunderstood the Honourable McClure by I thought he was saying, well, there are these processes already there and there is this time for, you know, the department to get to plan and get the funds. I understood that to mean then that we may not then need to go for the specific consultation because it would happen during the process of the budget request. But that's why I say I want this very clear so that we're all in agreement. Honourable McLaughlin, do you want to repeat that? Williams?
Not that, I think there is no disagreement. The issue whether do we repeat this or not, probably we shouldn't because there is a defined process. But remember when we come to section 106B, the A and B, we've decided to flag the matter. But we've agreed in principle about issues of ministers. The only matter we said wanted to flag was the language to be used then, whether in or after. That's one issue we agreed. Let's allow us to go in and flag it. The second flagging in the same matter is the usage of the word credit insurance and credit life insurance. We're actually exhausted. Then Ms. Gibson was supposed to deal with the last one. Which she had already started, which was section 29, so that we can be able to conclude on their comments. But when Member Dasha was asking, it was these issues to say, let's not try to hold back. Remember, okay, let me not talk about the other issue of the church. The savings, except to say that implementation must never be held back.
No.
This relief is so needed by our people under the current conditions. The sooner we do our process, but in a meticulous way, but expeditiously, it will bring the intended relief that is direly needed to move. Therefore, there is nothing wrong with the principle to say, from an implementation point of view, where we stand, there is a degree of comfort that capacity and resources will be mobilized. But whether they will be adequate or not, but if they are mobilized outside certain processes, you can't do outside other processes other than that are already legislated, how treasurer does processes. I thought I should clarify it that way, Comrade Chair.
Look, I'm now quite clear what you are saying. Thank you, Honourable McLaughlin. Thank you. Honourable Williams?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I'm of the opinion that perhaps it makes no difference if this... I know it says he must consult with the Minister of Finance, but if there is already a system in place, then, you know, there's no need to have this. In fact, we could remove it, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Mantush, having heard the Honourable McLaughlin again, do you align yourself with sentiment or have a slightly nuanced view? So that we are, you know, a committee where we do have these convictions, and that's why we are here. We're politicians. Yes. So no. It's so I will now rule on the matter. It will be flagged until Thursday. Are we all in agreement? Right. Now we're moving to the one and only Honourable Williams on slide 7. That's where I saw only. So, sorry, Ms. Gibson, you wanted to come in there quickly, but as it's going to be flagged, I think it'll be fine. Do you want Ms. Gibson to go through that again, or will you just comment?
I'll comment again, Shepherd, if you want me to hear my voice again. I'm not happy with putting only in there. I think that limitation shouldn't be put in there. That's all. I just want to say I don't want to limit anything. In particular, I know it's implied that he will only consider that the next minister, will only consider the points there, but I don't think that we should limit it, because there could be other things, and then what happens if there are other things? You know what I'm saying? So there could be something else. So I don't think we should put only in. I don't think we should limit the minister's scope in this particular case.
Right, so I don't want to put words into your mouth, Ms. Gibson, but I thought you to say that was one view. There were two perceptions here. One that it was only those factors, and one that it was broader. Is that correct? And that your concern may have been the ambiguity, but you actually wanted it to come back to only, to limit, or almost ring-fence the factors. Am I right? Perhaps you'd like to express it.
So broadly speaking, yes. I think that the legal interpretation that we have is that it would mostly be interpreted as limiting. So that if it went to court, a court would, but again, these are lawyers who are, it is the opinion that a court would find that the legislation implied and would hold it according to those elements. But it could still be argued the other way, and might actually, but it does create some space, which is exactly what is being discussed now. I think the point is taken around that what you're trying to do is make sure that this group of people that we've identified now, somehow we don't lose some of those people out of the group through no fault of their own, as it were, no. But just because there have been some other changing conditions.
No.
So I think we could also, maybe we could say that as well, that even if we don't say only, that it's not specifically limiting, but that the intention is clear, that it's to make sure that the same people that we're capturing now will be the same people that we capture in future, even if circumstances or the conditions change. And obviously it would not be, I'm sure we could find a much shorter way of saying it.
Well, look, I think you've really contextualised it within Mr. Honourable Williams' framework, and then I think that's it. We retain it then. Treasury thinks, well, look, we can leave only out, and we don't want to miss the target group. Honourable Ms. Norval?
No, I think this one is the advocate, when she presented, is the most explicit way, where she had to go and borrow the conditions. There is no need to insert any adjective like only or so. It's very specific. Those are the three. It's just, it's immaterial. Let's just leave the way they advocate they've done the amendment.
So we're all on the same page, Honourable Williams. I'm just checking.
Chipperson, yes, I was moving quickly to the next section, but it's okay, I'll wait for you.
And what sort of key word is that?
Right. No, fine, Honourable Williams, do address that. Roman 1.
Thank you. Chairperson, I think that we must also remember that the stakeholders must be consulted because they are part of it. So I do think that inserting after consultation with the relevant stakeholders is important because they must be consulted because, you know, we don't want a situation where they're not consulted and then there's an adjustment made that collapses our banking system. So I think that it's important that we do consult with the stakeholders. Thank you.
locating it, Honourable Williams. Right, okay. So, you're not disagreeing, you, in fact, in agreement.
Chairperson, absolutely. I think it's important that we mustn't... I know that the bill is definitely in... Or, let's put it this way. Our job is not only to defend the poor, our job is also to defend South Africa in general, and the stakeholders in this particular case need to be, after consultation with them, then the adjustment can be made. But it is an after-consultation situation, so I agree with this inclusion. Thank you.
Honourable McDougall?
No, I'm just saying for ease of reading of the point of reference, Ms. Gibson, she just decided to put romantic on there, but it should be reading is an 8... whatever, but it's a D1 because
D1, yes.
It comes in the first.
Yeah.
And then, but then she has inserted romantic at 3. It looks to me a bit more problematic. What, if she can explain what is the context, is a serious incision there.
You see, when I looked at this, and that's why I said now, I'm just finding it, I wondered if it was not a new. Yeah, I think you better talk to us, including all those little Romans.
But if you read the Romans...
Okay, so I think that... So, what we have in some of our laws is that where you adjust, like, levies or amounts within certain limits, parameters, you don't need to go through the full process as if you adjust outside of those parameters. So, where you can see it says or, it starts with or. My sense in also having engaged DTI on this is that the line that starts or is unnecessary, and that actually all we need is, when you see the Roman one, the insertion after consultation with relevant stakeholders table, and that's much more simple and that addresses the issues. So please, that is an alternative, but we're comfortable, and if the committee seems to be in agreement with the after consultation clause.
So there we have, oopsie, look at this, all the colours. Right, on the this point, Ms. Gibson, on the little fellow, where you've got slide 7, and we've got the bold, after consultation with relevant stakeholders, is referring to line 22 then, placing that in front, and you go further. Then you say, and a summary report of the consultation, no objections to a little summary, right? And then you've got and, which is what is here, right? And you move on, you're saying, or add in a new 3, but if you don't agree, it's an alternative. The all means option.
I don't agree.
So now wait, this is now getting much more robust.
I'll
right.
Take the last, the
Honourable
first part. Global. The first part agreed.
Yeah.
The last part, the all part, no. No.
Yeah. Well, let's get some agreement here. Honourable Williams, the first part agreed to, is that, do you concur?
Chairperson, I proposed the first part. So after consultation, I agree with that. But the second part, for all, I disagree that we shouldn't add anything like that. Thank you.
Well, there we are. It was simply an option, but let's get Advocate Van der Merwe's opinion.
Can I just ask? I think the principle that the committee agrees to is that before the minister proposes any adjustment to National Assembly, there must be some consultation and there must be a summary made of that, concepts consulted on, and that must be tabled within the National Assembly. May I just ask that I'd be allowed, and maybe with DTI's drafter, to just go and work on where it fits in best. Because what we currently have is we'll say before the minister makes the adjustment, the minister must after having consulted. So we kind of have before and after in the same sentence, which reads a little bit difficult. And I know that Treasury did this very, very quickly. So I think the idea that I'm saying is I understand that the committee wants consultation, wants a summary, but can it maybe just be given some leeway to maybe insert it somewhere else if it fits better?
Thank you, Advocate Van der Merwe. Honourable McLawball.
No, Chair, from our side, there is no confusion, Advocate. This point that Treasurer is saying, it gets inserted on Roman figure 1 at the beginning. You see that Roman figure 1 that is there when you look at 22. How does it happen to then look like in terms of the actual waiting? But this is where our understanding, and that's why Honourable Comrade Williams proposed, we seconded him. It does the amendment of Roman figure 1.
I'm looking, wait just one moment, I do see DTI's hand. You know, the Honourable Williams' name sort of came into the conversation. Yes, and I didn't see any comment from you. Right, DTI?
Chair, thanks. What I wanted to sort of clarify, I mean, if we're going to include after consultation on Roman figure 1, we'll just be repeating what is already said under 2 capital A and then small a, where we are saying if the minister may once every 24 months by notice in the government event, that's actually the actual consultation process, which actually involves publishing whatever proposal that you have for wider consultation, get the inputs way before you actually approach the National Assembly. So between those two paragraphs, we would be actually repeating what is already on
the need to enable members to follow you. That's page 18. It is line 55 or so, in 55, 56 or so. So you see that there, line 55 at the bottom of page 18. That's what you're referring to,
yes.
Am I right, Mr. Comcast?
By issuing a notice in the Government Gazette, this is the beginning of the consultation process.
Right, let's just look at that. The Minister may once every 12 months by notice of the Gazette, and after having considered those factors, etc., adjust the amount contemplated in the definition of debt intervention applicant, etc., etc. But now, that was in the Gazette or our dead consultation. You alerted people. But now you're actually seeking to do the adjustment itself. And I think this may be where the Honourable Williams is just trying to come in. So the one issue is that you consider the following factors and then you publish in the Gazette. And the Gazette means anyone who's heard of it, open it and check. But that's all it does. Honourable Williams, I just want to take Honourable Williams first. Honourable McLawell has raised this point.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I disagree with DTI. I don't think those two clauses are a repeat of one another. Like you said, the first one gets gazetted after the minister's considered, and then the second one that we're saying we should add is that then after consultation with relevant stakeholders, then that decision is made. So the minister first makes a decision and gazettes it, and then before the actual figures are decided, there is consultation with the stakeholders. Whereas the first clause that was talked to doesn't even imply that you should have any consultation with anybody. The minister could sit in his office by himself and make that decision to gazette it.
I'd like to hear what Ms. Gibson is just saying, but I also want to remind members that earlier Advocate Van der Merwe spoke about, yes, but maybe it doesn't fit in there, maybe it needs to come earlier. And I'm just reminding members about that statement. Right.
Yes, I would like to echo that same comment of the Honourable Member to say that even when the Act is promulgated, that Act of promulgation will be by the debt. So it's really, it's an official notification of something, as opposed to, you could be officially notifying that you're going to publicly engage, but that's not what that clause says. It's basically, it's describing the point in time at which that that adjustment takes effect and becomes formal.
Confusing,
you know, the way that arm gets raised.
Honourable Matlobo. No, thanks, Chair. I'm just seconding Comrade Williams. His explanation is point. It's very straight to the point. When you look at the reference, the one that we're talking about, which is D now, because the amendment is on D, it says that those things that we have done either on paragraph A or B, then there is a tabling. You can't be tabled without engaging the relevant stakeholders. That's why we're saying from our side, there is no confusion where this amendment of treasurer must be inserted. It gets inserted on that point A before the word table blah, 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 blah comes in. Therefore, Comrade Williams is correct.
I noticed that there are some members who not commenting, and I know there's such a thing as active silent participation. So I'm just hoping that that's where we are. But I'm going over to, and for that matter, you know, I'm also looking at the entities. I just hope we're not confusing you, but we're trying to ensure that what we had earlier agreed on at the beginning, which was, yes, let's have a consultation with relevant stakeholders, but we won't have the or, we won't have the other option. We'd agreed on that, but Advocate Vanda Merva was trying to perhaps draw our attention to the fact that it may not be in the appropriate place in the bill. Now, I wonder if, having heard us, Advocate Vanda Merva, and this may put you on a, you know, a spot, but I don't know if you feel strong enough to comment, or would you like to have the National Credit Regulator just come in first? Yeah.
I'm not concerned about where in the bill it sits. My concern is that we have the words before and after in the same sentence. So it's just to correct that. So what I would probably, having quickly now thought about it, do is it would rather read for the minister makes the adjustment contemplated in paragraph A or B, the minister must, one, consult relevant stakeholders and provide a summary to the National Assembly. Two, table the adjusted amount in the National Assembly. Three, obtain the approval. So what I'm just asking is, because proposals have been made to the committee for wording, I'm just asking for a little bit of leeway that we can tinker with the wording just to make it read well.
I mean, you know, when one is composing anything, one needs time to think about the implications. Yes, the Chief Executive Officer from the National Credit Regulator, Ms. Montegari.
Oh, no, I actually wanted to say the same thing, to say we are going to have to interpret this, so it's confusing the way it is where you have before and after your sentence, so, but she's, that's okay, just clarified it. Thank you.
That's really all it is. And there's no objection. I'm looking at everyone here. Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, absolutely. I think the advocate's correct. She must write this legislation to express our intent.
Yeah.
It is our intent that we're talking about, and then they come in with the law, the way it's written. Thank you.
And Ms. Gibson, then you heard the comments of the committee members then, and it was good of you to offer us an option as well. So that we didn't feel compelled to just take one. But yeah, we were given a choice. So, but we've said, no, we don't want the option. Thank you very much. All right. And then, just help me. Well, are we done? 106? Oh, yes, we are. It was just that we went somewhat backwards then. And, I do need to make sure we've covered it all here. There was one here, the limits. There's one or two areas where we were already agreeing to just do a bit of flagging. Is that correct, Honourable Mantash, Honourable Khadebe, one or two or three? Honourable Kacharya, I think it'll be important for you to communicate with your colleague that what we have flagged, you know, would be important. But we would certainly like members to be considering these issues so that by the time we do get to next week, all being on track, as it were. Because tomorrow, I am concerned because if we're going to go flag by flag and we've got some things flagged, you know, I mean clause by clause, and now we've got three flags, one Honourable MacPherson's, two here, you know, that we can't just speedily go clause by clause. Do you agree, Honourable Kacharya?
Yes, but are we going to go through clause by clause tomorrow? In the absence of...
That was originally the plan.
In the absence of MacPherson,
yes.
Which you explicitly asked for now, if we to brief him so he can get input, I don't know how you square that, the Honourable.
Also, I have requested all parties who have members sitting on this committee to please send an alternate if they cannot avail themselves. And that applies to the IFP, they have a member sitting in energy, and they are not conducting a bill. They are not deliberating over legislation. It applies to the EFF, which is also not deliberating over legislation. So we ask Mr. Hurwitz not simply to SMS and phone, but actually to send a letter to communicate in writing on this matter. This is a very important piece of legislation. I do not want to delay this bill, but on the other hand, I can't just move ahead when there are serious concerns that are raised by more than one member. So I look towards the whip as well. If I look at tomorrow's program, for example, we have got two options here. One option is to, let's see, it's the 22nd, isn't it, is to start off with the copyright, go on with the copyright, and finish copyright the whole of Wednesday. All right? That's what's stated currently. And then on Thursday, copyright. And I think that is a constructive approach to the matter. It enables us to have communicated effectively with all parties and enables us that with flags, etc., to discuss it within our caucuses, these flags and inverted commas, and to come back so that we can go clause by clause by clause on Tuesday. But I look to yourself, Honourable Khadebe, for a comment, and then yourself, Honourable Alberts. Yes, Honourable Khadebe.
Chairperson, in the original agreement we had, is that we deal with clause by clause next Tuesday. So what must happen is that the parties must go and look at the issues which they were not comfortable with.
You wouldn't you go over that?
Chairperson, I said that we agreed on those by those on the credit amendment bill on Tuesday, but gave the parties a chance to go and look at those issues which they were not comfortable with. So I think that we must put some sort of a deadline that at least by Tuesday next week, when we come in the morning, we deal with the flags, and then we must have them. So that by afternoon or evening, we really deal with the source by source in its entirety.
Indeed, I am of that opinion, and when I look at the Tuesday, we have a slight challenge. We're looking at the 28th of August, and it's not going to be the formal consideration is for clause by clause. It is for consideration, but you know, we've already heard what other measures must be in place and processes. We then, and this is for Ms. Naidu, we then need to defer the steel sugar tariff issue. I'm looking at members now as well. Don't tell me now you thought it was going to be steel and what. And then the briefing on the performance protection. We're going to defer that. We are going to focus on the National Credit Amendment Bill on Tuesday. Tomorrow, copyright. All right? And Thursday. Now, and remember when the whip is saying, and then I do want to come back to yourself, Honourable Alberts and Honourable Kacharya, that we'll do the flags. What we're doing is the flags are going to go out the way. Oh, we're dealing with that in the first hour. Do you understand? And then after that first hour, we are going clause by clause by clause. And we are voting at the end of the day, if necessary. You see? Now, Honourable Kacharya, do you wish to make any comments?
No, that's clear. I'm happy with that.
Honourable Albert?
Madam Chair, that's an order. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And you can see our appeal, Honourable Albert, because you do add value. I know how busy all parties are. In fact, I don't even know what a weekend looks like anymore. That you try and avail yourself fully on the next Tuesday, please, Honourable Albert. Thank you. Now, we've taken a decision, and I am appealing to the DTI, the National Credit Regulator, the National Consumer Tribunal, all of you who work in that field of health, to please make yourself fully available. And my appeal to the whip is going to be we start sharp at 10. Honourable whip, we start sharp at 10 on Tuesday. Sharp. Yeah, and not that you need to be sharp, it's me. But there we are. So that's the National Credit Amendment Bill. But now there is the copyright. All right? Now when I look, yes, I know that you want to get hold of my ear, but just a minute. So right now, what we did have here, just to remind members, we did note that we would come back and work on the copyright at 4:30. It is now 4:30 or so. Right. Now, that's on the program, and we specifically requested the time out of plenary to address this. So, who's dealing with copyright in the DTI? Of course, the DDG. Sorry, is there tea? Oh, the team. I thought there was tea. Why is there tea? May we have a 5-minute comfort break?
Remember on Tuesday. Remember that was getting.
Does she know about that?
No, we have to.
Come with, are we done?
No,
but we're tired.
You're
right. I don't know why I'm
early days. Why do I have to work until late?
I'm sorry.
Hey, how are you?
Thank you.
No.